on Zoom, we can do a meeting at some time future, and hopefully no one is having any difficulty. Is there any public comment? Anyone wanting to raise their hand, John?
No.
Okay. Agenda review. I would like to add somewhere along here Kevin Warden from Tego General Store Renovations would like to speak briefly. He has put in the turning studies, and he may be on the line. Is he at the meeting, John?
He is, yes.
Okay. So I would like to add that. Other than that, I have nothing to add. And the brick building repairs, John Moore has not gotten together with whoever. And he does not have anything for that. So we can take that off. Are there any other additions or changes to agenda as it is?
Emily, this is Scott. Just a couple of clarifications, just so it's not clear totally in the agenda. So we're the Vermont State Police, that's the renewal. So that's what's up for. That's the agenda item, is renewal of the Vermont.
Well, it's a new contract. The contract expires as of today. And yeah. I included the new contract was in the packet that the state police sent, and we need to discuss whether we want to renew or not.
Okay, so it is a renewal of the same, basically same contract, new term.
Yes, correct.
Okay, and we're actually, for the forest fire warden, this is the recommendation to the state for the state to appoint the forest fire warden, the town forest fire warden. And
they have given us a recommendation, and we either have to accept it or tell them why we don't want that person or find a different person. So we have to comment on their recommendation, and then they appoint. And there's a form in the letter that they sent regarding that.
Okay, is that...
So we have to decide whether we want to have them reappoint Frank, which is what they recommended, or whether we do not.
Okay, cool. Okay, great. So, and is that letter also in there?
It is not, because I only received it. I only went up to the office on Monday and got the letter.
Okay. I think that's it. The only other clarification is this is something we should talk about under 5H, the ATV and dirt bike ordinance. It occurred to me after the agenda was published that it's not clear in the ordinance whether it covers dirt bikes or not. So that should be part of that discussion, because it's actually technically an ATV and snowmobile ordinance, and it doesn't specifically address dirt bikes. But one thing we should talk about is whether that ordinance is intended to cover dirt bikes.
Anything else?
No, that's it.
Does anyone else have any other items that they wish to add? Or I don't know. Steve, are you there? Did you get back any bids? The truck bids are not on this agenda, and that was my fault. Do you have truck bids to open today?
We do not, because after I spoke with you, when they didn't get the whole RFP for whatever reason, they are a lot happier if we gave them till the 15th after I sent the pages that they didn't get.
That sounds good to me. So I think it should have been on the agenda if we were going to do it anyway, and that was probably my fault to not get it there. Any other questions?
So I don't know if we want to put it on just to vote on moving that date to the 15th. I mean, I don't know if that's if we have to be that technical or not, but.
I think we better probably do that. So let's add that somewhere here. changing dates on truck RFP. Anything else? Then, moving on. Approval of 6/17/2020 minutes. Does anyone have any problems with those?
No, no issues here.
So I need a motion?
So moved.
A second?
Second.
All those in favor of approving the minutes as presented in the packet, signify by saying aye. John?
Aye.
Scott?
Aye.
Chuck?
Aye.
Steve?
Aye.
Myself, aye. Moving on. Warrants for approval. I would move that we have three warrants for approval. 19123 for $18,416.16. 19126 for $6,330.13. And a payroll warrant 20100 for $8,229.00. Did you get those, Cindy? Is Cindy there, John?
She is. She's muted.
Here we go. I did get those, and there's one more.
There's another one?
Yes. Did you say 20101?
No, I didn't see that one.
That's accounts payable for $91,346.94.
$346.40?
94, I'm sorry.
This is Ellen. I haven't really checked in. Can you hear me?
Yes Ellen.
So that warrant that Cindy just mentioned is the first one of the brand new fiscal year, and it has a number of those one-time payments and dues that we've talked about coming due at the very beginning of July.
Okay. Did you send that to us or not?
We did, but it got done very late in the day, so it might not have been in the email until almost 2:30.
Okay. I don't find it on my computer, but that doesn't mean anything. What did you say, John?
It was came through at 2:26. If that's the right one.
Yeah, it is.
Okay. I'm not finding that on my email. It must have been sent somewhere else. That's all right. Does anyone have any problem with that? Anything on that one?
Has everybody seen it?
That did not, for some reason, that did not get to my computer.
Do you want me to run down a quick list of what's on it?
That would be great.
So it has $321 for the printing of the annual tax bills, $466.44 for town electric bills, that second phase of the Nikon crack sealing at $13,050. I put that in there because we received it, but that doesn't mean it has to be mailed. I wasn't sure. At one point, there was some concern about whether they had completed what they had been asked to do. So anyway, that's there, but I won't mail the check until you tell me to. A bill from the fire department for supplies, I believe, $1,703.80. Swish, $99.20, that supplies for the highway. The ambulance and dispatch fees to the town of Woodstock, $63,280. Annual dues for Two Rivers, $1,383. Annual dues for VLCT, $2,190. $50 for membership dues at the Vermont Assessors and Listers Association, and $8,803.50. That is half of the annual dues for the Windsor County Courthouse. and the rest of that would be due by November.
That sounds good to me.
I myself had a question that I wanted to pose about one of the other sets of minutes, which was warrant number 19123. It was the one that had the most recent bill for Stitzel, Page, and Fletcher, which was for $798. And I was, my question concerns the part of that that's billed to general municipal fees, because my reading of it, but maybe I'm wrong, is that the lion's share of that bill is all the phone calls and discussions that were handled with regard to Scott's question as to whether the vote for the zoning was done kosher. And so I guess my first question is that, was the lion's share of that bill all attributable to getting the legal answer from Stitzel and Page as to whether that vote that was initially taken on the adoption of the new zoning, is that the cost of that? Because there have been other times when Scott has questioned votes by the select board, and if this is a very clear and obvious charge for the question of those matters, I just think that that's something the town should be aware of and it should be discussed.
Let me jump in here, Ellen. So I did not initiate any dialogue with Stitzel, Page, and Fletcher.
But your call for the fact that it was not a legitimate vote was the start of that whole discussion.
That's correct. But I did not initiate any kind of transaction with Joe McLean. So
when you file a complaint, there has to be a reply. So you can't say that you didn't actually start the whole thing, because your filing of the complaint is the start. And what is the town supposed to do? Not get a proper answer to you?
Right. So that's not what I'm saying, Ellen. The town does have to get legal advice, and that's correct. And it did.
So I'm just trying to point out that every time you file a legal complaint against the town, you are running up the town's legal bill. And you're doing that as essentially as one person out of a board that is not happy with the other four members' vote on an issue.
So I think that's where you're not correct, Ellen, and we can, this is not on the agenda, but I'm happy to have this debate. But yes, it's correct that I did initiate, and I guess you're also leaving aside, Ellen, the importance of the issue, and that there was some benefit to raising this claim. And that it did teach us a lesson. But I did not, the town, the board, voted to consult with Stitchell, Page, and Fletcher. So that's my point, is there was a vote, as I recall,
There was no vote. When you filed the complaint, I sought legal guidance from VLCT. They would not touch it with a 10-foot pole. And because I believe it was a Friday or a Thursday, and the meeting was not going to be for another week or 10 days, and I don't remember the exact dates of the meeting, I consulted with my vice chair, and the vice chair says, you better call Stitchell and Page, because we've got to answer this complaint in the number of days. And so I initiated that reluctantly, because I didn't want to pay a bill, because I thought we already had enough legal bills. But because of the action you took, you put the board in that position. And yeah. So there was no vote to consult with them. And I did that because the board was faced with a complaint. And okay. The board had to figure out whether it was a valid complaint or not. And you were party to all of those emails. You were not excluded from any of them.
Yep.
But any conversation through email that I had with Stitchell and Page, you were also a party to, because you were on the board. And so you know exactly what was said and what was not said in any one of those emails.
Understood. But the point I'm making is that I did not... it was not my decision. The board could have chose not to seek legal advice if it wanted to. So if it didn't want to run up a bill, it could have chose to do that. So Ellen is not correct.
I'm not sure that I accept that explanation.
Well, okay, do we want to keep having this debate in the context of approving the warrants, or I'm happy to keep going if you want, but you know,
I don't know where it's going to go.
I
think the point has been made at this point, and I think we have a motion on the floor, and if any of the board members wish to not pay that bill right away and discuss it at a future date, we can not do that if that's what you all want. However, the motion right now is to pay all the bills. And so I'm looking to the board as to whether they want to continue this discussion, whether you want to leave this bill out and discuss it at a later date, this payment, or what you want to do in this regard, because it's time to move on.
I'll second the motion.
Is there any more discussion on the various warrants up for approval? That being said, all those in favor of approving the four warrants that we have before us, signify by saying aye. John?
Aye.
Scott?
Aye.
Chuck?
Aye.
Steve?
Aye.
And myself, aye. Okay. Road foreman's report. Jimmy, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Give us your report.
Okay. So we're still working at the grave in the kitchen. This weather's kind of here for that. And I've had to stop doing it at different times because of going back and forth to Owl Hill, but we're making progress at it. But I'm going to have to stop doing the ditching right now and pull some roads together. All the roads that I've ditched and graded have stood up to this rainstorm, which was a good feeling to be able to look back and see that. So I just didn't keep going ditching, but I got to get some other roads graded that I haven't even gotten to this year. So then we'll go back to doing the ditching, but that's where that part of it's at. Past couple of rainy days and went on and off, we've taken the grader and the loader and washed it all up in good shape and did a bunch of sanding on it and did a bunch of painting on them and whatnot, and their upkeep looks pretty good right now. But the aprons all swept up. That Nate from construction down to Tego there, he called me today and wanted me to come down. They were marking out the turbine and stuff down there. I didn't have the chance to run down there, but I'm pretty sure they've gotten that done to look at. I called and got some prices on dumpsters. That Moore solution out of White River there, they were $140 a month, but tipping it every other week. And if we wanted to do some recycling, that was going to be $10 a month extra, so it was going to be $150 a month, and they recycle every other Monday. And Casella's was a four-yard dumpster, every other week dumping it at $162 a month, and I did not get anything back on them yet on what it would cost for the recycling. So I did get those two prices back on that. The Urban Oil. Yeah, go ahead.
Did you get anything from Able?
I haven't yet, no. I can do that because that's who I use. I forgot to reach out to him, to be honest with you. So I can do that. I'll call him and see.
Okay, so you're not ready for a decision on that then yet?
No,
anyway.
Not now then. Now that you brought that up, because I totally spaced that one right out. So thank you for bringing that up. Yes, I will call them tomorrow. And then that Urban Oil there, we had that discussion a while back on trying to get them to come in, and instead of getting heating fuel and diesel fuel, they did the research on it as well, and it would be fine to hook into our diesel tank and be able to feed our furnace. And a lot of other towns around do the same thing. And with our state permit that we got, we're not able to keep I have 55 gallon drums of oil in there because of that 275 gallon fuel barrel that's in there for the heating oil was hampering us from having that. So we got all these 5-gallon pails screwed around. So Urban Oil, a while back there, we discussed on, they gave me a price to come in and do it and discontinue that heating oil and feed out of that. Well, they were there today and they got that done. So we'll be able to save some money now, I think, moving forward on buying our oils in 55-gallon drums instead of 5-gallon pails all the time.
That sounds good.
I have a hand up. I'm not sure what it's about, but Richard Martin.
Richard, do you have something to say?
Emily, I just wanted to bring it to Jim's attention. Maybe he already knows, but as a result of the rain the last 3 days, there's a major washout right in, down Howe Hill, a little bit from my driveway. And it's about to undermine the asphalt that has been applied to the road. And then another, as we walk the road, I noticed that, and maybe we want to have Harrington take a look at this, but some of the culverts that have been installed are already starting to fill up with mud.
We're fully aware of all that, and we fixed up a couple of the washouts down on near the Hewittville School, and we got a meeting on that one that you're talking about Monday to discuss on how we're going to approach it and go about that. And we are aware of a little bit of silt. When you say mud, it's not a lot of mud. It's mainly just silt because everything was so dry that we got that quick rain so quick yesterday afternoon. But it's once we get able to get some grass growing on it and stuff, they'll clean themselves, no problem, what little bit there is. We have looked at them and inspected them, and we're pretty confident that moving forward it won't really bother them culverts.
Excellent, Jim. I thank you for all that you do.
Yep, we thank you. We appreciate your patience up there on that project for sure.
Anything else, Jim? How are you coming on mowing the roadside?
He's been in mowing. He's been mowing 3 days a week. He's been over, I had him over on the south end of town. He's got the blacktop mowed other than Howe Hill, but I didn't really want to have him up on that Howe Hill project. So he's still got Howe Hill to do. Preferably, if they're not coming in to pave next week, tentatively that was my plan, is to have him go up and mow that now with that base coat being hard. But he's been over on the south end of town. He's got pretty much all that south end done. I call it south end, Sugar Bush. He's working his way back. He's got all the cloud land done. He's only got the river road left and a little bit of high pastures left. From there, he's moving this way. I'll move him up to Wild Apple Road and he'll work his way through the rest of the road.
That's great.
They did start bringing me a little sand here and there, but we got to be the first ones on the list, and I called him again the other day, said I'd like to see it a little more steadier, and he said he understood that, and there we're going to work at getting it there more steadier, so I believe him. I think he will get that done. One thing that did happen to me today is our refrigerator in that shop has kind of been acting funny lately anyway, but it has pretty much gone on the blank, and I don't really think it's worth repairing it, and I didn't. It happened late this afternoon, so I noticed it late this afternoon, but if I can get the okay to spend a couple $100 on buying a refrigerator, I think that would be good.
Well, we don't need to take out bids on that or anything. Does any of the board have any feeling on the refrigerator?
It's old enough. Yeah, I wouldn't. It's not like it's a $2,000 refrigerator, so probably cheaper to just get a new one anyways.
I think you're probably right. So do we need to vote to give Jim permission to do that, or can he just go and get a fridge?
I think it's a small enough amount. He just go ahead and get himself a refrigerator.
Yeah, that seems like that.
Is everybody else okay with that?
Yeah, that makes sense to me.
Is that all right with you, Chuck?
Yeah.
Okay, you can get yourself a refrigerator, Jim.
All right. And then... Howe Hill there, we did have some washouts, as Mr. Martin talked about there. We fixed up a couple of them here today, and we're working with Pike now on some other issues. They were up there doing some more tidying up and trying to clean up and whatnot. But what happened was is we just got that rain so quick that it washed out on the edges. And, of course, we had that berm there, and there weren't really enough cutouts there, adequate ones. But moving forward here, they've made better practice at it. So I think we shouldn't have to deal with it again, we hope. So, but they're the band rail, like I say, the band rail, they started installing the band rail and they're anticipating being done with that, but they're coming back in Friday and finish our end up on the band rail. So the tentative plan is they're going to pave the finished coat on it, not next week, but the following week, I guess. So
great.
That's moving along there. I did get the Bunker Hill culverts ordered and whatnot, but I'm waiting on prices right now from a couple individuals on a pecking to remove some of that ledge up there and put some of the culverts in so we can get a decent pitch down through there. So once I get that and we get the approval to move, I get the approval to move ahead with that, then I can schedule that project because we're kind of going to have to be there as they're there, uncovering an area and seeing where we can can't put these culverts in. We have done some test pits up through there where these culverts got to go, the new ones, and on the edges, and there's a lot of ledge around there. So that project is kind of on the hold up until these individuals get back to me with some prices. Gladys, I did order the culvert for Ron Gladys, I call it Ron Gladys, but Caper Street, and that was a 4-footer, and I'm hopefully going to be scheduled in to do that the first week in August. We'll get that
okay.
One. So, and then I did end up, they come up and met with me, and we did order the uniforms, and they should be coming along fairly soon. And
good.
Then the other thing that I had was, I know the last executive session on the reviews and whatnot, got postponed. I was looking for a follow-up on when we thought we might be doing that again.
We will schedule something tonight. Does any while Jimmy's still with us, does anyone want to discuss when we might do those reviews? Do you want to do those next Wednesday?
Sure, that sounds good.
Works for me.
Does that work for you, Chuck and John?
Yeah.
Yep.
Okay, so we'll have next Wednesday. Jimmy, you at 7:30. Cindy, does that work for you?
Yes, 8:00.
Okay. Jimmy's will be at 7:30. We'll meet at 7, and Cindy's will be at 8. Okay?
That'll work.
Okay, sounds good. I don't know what day that is, but it must be. Excuse me?
That's all it for me.
Okay. there was something I was going to ask you, but Kevin Warden wrote me back an email. You said that they had painted those things?
I had to go up and look at Wild Apple Road this afternoon, and I looked over there and I could see they were in the process of putting some orange paint up in the front of the area, near the store there and whatnot. And then he's been very communicating with me back and forth. I really wanted me to come down and look at it today. And as they were doing it, whatnot, but I did not have the time to go down. And so I told him, sorry, but I didn't have the time to come down.
He emailed me yesterday that they would be done by 5:00. Unfortunately, that was too late to schedule a meeting, but we need to go down. I sent you all the turning studies that he sent back to me, and we need to schedule a site visit to go down there and see where the things that Tego wants to put in the road right away are going to be. And I would suggest that we do that as soon as we can. And it's up to the board's pleasure as to when you all want to do that. But I think if he's got the stuff painted down there, we should get down there and take a look. And also, those turning studies are now here. And there were some suggestions from the pedestrian guy that will have to be incorporated in anything that they do. So what would anybody's availability be to go down there and do a site visit with those various things depicted on the ground?
I could do it first thing in the morning. They are painted on the ground. I was down there around 5 o'clock or so, and they are all marked out.
Good. This is Kevin Ward. I'm available for any questions if you have any tonight, but otherwise I'll defer to you.
Jimmy is off tomorrow because of the holiday. Is that not correct, Jimmy? That's what you told me?
That's correct. Yes, we are.
So can we schedule something the first of the week so Jimmy doesn't have to come in?
We could, or on Friday.
Well, Jimmy, it's the 4th of July weekend, and they don't work on Friday.
Okay.
So,
Jim, are you guys off tomorrow and Friday or just tomorrow?
No, we're off. We're off tomorrow and Friday because we seem to have to work 4 10-hour days.
Gotcha.
See what I mean? We don't work Friday.
Yep. You're working your four schedule. Yep.
Yep.
So could we go down there? Like, would it fit in with your schedule, Jim, if we went down there Monday morning?
Whenever. I mean, if you need me to come down there tomorrow, I mean, I don't have a problem going down there just as long as it's early in the morning, the first thing in the morning. I don't oppose it. If I got to go down there, that's fine.
It's whatever the board wants to do. I don't mind going down there early in the morning.
I don't either. It's convenient for me.
What time? 7.
Mr. Warden, when can you get there? Or can you get there in the morning?
Yeah, I'm actually out of town for a long weekend. I won't be able to go until early next week, but I don't think I need to be there. Paint kind of shows what it needs to.
John, are you and Steve available?
I wouldn't be able to. I could do it a morning, but not tomorrow. I'd have to find somebody to come.
You've got to work. How about Monday morning when Jimmy would be back on staff anyway?
Yeah, I can make Monday work.
Can you make that one, John?
Yep.
What about you, Steve?
I can make Monday.
Let's do Monday at, you start at 6, don't you, Jimmy?
Yep.
Do you want to get your crew going or can you have them going by 6? So we can meet down there at like 6?
Yeah, we can do that.
Is that okay with the rest of the board?
Yeah, it works for me.
Sounds good. Sure.
Yep.
Is that okay with you, Chuck?
Yes.
6 o'clock Monday morning, site visit. This is not a meeting to discuss anything, just to look at something. Does that need to be warned, Scott?
No, site visits are exempt.
Okay, great. If you want to come, Mr. Warden, we'd be glad to. If you desire to be there, that's great. And if you don't, we'll look it over, and we won't be making any decision, but we will be able then to hopefully make a decision at the following board meeting.
Sounds good. I won't be there at that hour. Maybe the folks from DEW will. So.
Okie doke. We'll do that on Monday morning then. We'll schedule that in. Anything else for Jimmy on Road Foreman's report or anything else that needs to be figured out there? The only question I have, Jimmy, is that Ellen says we have now received 2 bills from Pike. And I don't know where they are in the queue with John approving those. And what Ellen asked me that question the other day and on Monday when I was up there and got the mail. And I did not have an answer for her as to are we supposed to be paying those? Are they approved? Are they not? Or are we going to pay everything at the end?
At this point in the game, with some of the rising issues that have moved forward, I mean, if we can wait and try to do it all in one shot, I think we might be better off to do it that way.
That's okay with me.
and I have not talked to John. I know John was waiting for some stuff to come back still on a couple of change orders that he's been trying to get for a couple, 3 weeks or longer now, and he hasn't gotten any results out of that. So I think till some of that stuff gets resolved as well, I think we're better off to hold off to the end if we can.
Okay. Anybody have any other questions of Jimmy? Okay, moving on to items for discussion or vote, winter maintenance policy. John, you put that on?
I did. We started this a while ago, and it was kind of in the middle of the winter, which wasn't a great time to discuss it. We do have one that's on the town website. It's kind of old and outdated. I started this when I was working for the town, is what got me thinking about it and involved. I did come up with a draft that I had circulated there a couple of years ago, which is on SharePoint, which I neglected to share via email. I did share this, the one from the state. I don't know if anybody looked at that or not. Did anybody see that?
I did not, but now that I know what you want to do, maybe we should get prepared for the next meeting.
Yep.
Or the meeting after.
Yep.
And get all those drafts kind of collated and some suggestions as to how the original one might want to be changed.
Yes. Yep. So there's one on the town website that's our current one. Then there's the one in SharePoint, which I can circulate via email the link for that. And then there's the one that I sent out Sunday, I guess, which is the state one, which is way lengthier and in depth than we need, obviously, but it does have some good information in there, especially with salt use and temperatures and things like that. So,
okay.
I certainly welcome input from Jimmy as well. So,
okay. Let's continue this discussion then at the next meeting, and that'll be our research.
Emily, this is Kevin Warden. Sorry to chime in, but I don't have an agenda. Are you all set with me, or will this topic come back up again?
I hope, because I guess I've been getting your emails. I hope that by scheduling this site visit, that we can get you, now that we've got the information, hopefully that we need, we can get you an answer sooner rather than later. We'd love to have you stay for the rest of the meeting if you would like. But seeing that you came up early, you don't have to. I guess the question to you is from us, is there anything else you want us to consider at this point?
I think the only other thing is there's also a proposed water line from Artistry to the store, and that crosses Library Street. So that would need an approval from the board in addition to the curbing and sidewalks proposed in the right-of-way.
And we were aware of that as well. And Natural Resources has, I guess you have to, because you're going through the brook, you have to get permission from them as well. And we've gotten notification of that.
Great.
So
We'd go under the brook, actually. They would bore under the brook.
So, we will consider that as well. Any other questions that anybody of the board has for Mr. Warden?
Mr. Warden, this is Jim here, Potter. Yep. I do know that I want to let you know that you can pass it on, but all the dealings that I've had with Nate down there, he's been very, very good to deal with.
Great. Well, that's good to hear. He'll be there for a while, so hopefully.
He's been a good guy to deal with.
Good. Yeah, and I think in addition to the truck turning radiuses I've done, now that there's paint on the pavement, you could actually turn vehicles. And I just would suggest, at a certain point, we have some opportunity to give a little more basis of why we came up with the design and answer questions. And if you're interested in alternatives, it'd be great to have a conversation about what those might be.
Once we do the site visit, we would be more than, or I would at least be more than delighted to have a conversation. This is a back and forth, and trying to find a solution that works for us all. We're not trying to be confrontational.
Yep. Great. Thank you.
Any other questions for Mr. Warden? Then moving on, Vermont State Police contract. This got included in your packet. They have not had a rate increase. This is the same rates that they had last year. And there is $22,000 in the budget that we passed. So the question is, do you want to continue with that much coverage? And if indeed that is the case, are there any things that we are looking for in addition to what they've been doing in the past? I did notice when I went up on How Hill this evening for another matter that there was a state police cruiser down on Sharon's side of How Hill and two wreckers. So obviously somebody went off the road somewhere there. I do think that if that road is improved, there's going to be some speeding issues, and we may want to have them spend more time up there. I don't think they're in this end of town very often. And so this contract is up for discussion.
I move that we approve it.
Is there a second?
I'll second.
Just to get the conversation going.
Any discussion?
I'd like to, I don't know, I don't travel the back roads too often. I see them down by the store and the school. That's the main stretch of road that I travel, at least on a daily basis. I'd like to see them a little more spread out through town. I don't know if they're on back roads or not, but it would be great to see them in some other locations, even if they're not necessarily sitting there waiting for speeders, at least showing their presence, I guess.
I do know that they come down Dana Road. I've seen them on Dana Road. They come down by here. I've seen them probably a couple times, at least a couple times, if not more, a month coming down Dana Road.
Anyone know whether we get any sort of periodic report of what they've seen, those kinds of stops, where they've covered over a certain period of time? Are we getting any stats like that?
They do send a monthly report as the hours that they work and which officers work the hours. Mm-hmm. They do not, or at least I have not seen in those reports, any indication of how many people they stop, what they stop them for, and on what locations they are sitting. So yes and no. We know the numbers of hours that they're working per month, but the one thing that I find a little discouraging is that, and I'm not suggesting that we should be in the ticket writing business, but it doesn't seem like there are any speeding tickets being written, or at least we're not getting benefit from them if they are. And if we're just going to warn people, I don't think that is quite as effective as people now and then getting a ticket so that they know we're not just kidding. And that's just my humble opinion. And I don't have any strong feeling, but it's quite a bit of money. The only other thing that I considered doing, but I did not, is to whether or not you wanted to get a price again from the Sheriff's Department. I know that Bridgewater said they couldn't afford them anymore. Maybe we can't either, but they might be in the frame of mind to give us a pretty good price. They did write more tickets than the state police. The state police, on the other hand, if they're in town, they respond to other calls as well. if they hear them on their scanner. So there is a benefit to having them here in that regard versus a sheriff. But I have no feeling one way or another on this whole thing.
I think the Bridgewater thing, I mean, they were spending, I don't know, well over $100,000 a year because they had them up there 12 hours a day, 7 days a week. So from what I remember, the state police was actually more money per hour than the sheriff's department, but we felt that we got better service from them initially, I guess, why we switched. But
yeah, that's right, John. It was about the service level more than anything.
Right.
Not so much price.
Yeah.
But I would, I don't know that this is necessarily a contract thing, but if we can request some periodic stats, including what you're describing, Emily, on stops and what the result was, and just so we have a sense of what kind of enforcement is going on. And we're going to talk in a little bit about our ATV and snowmobile ordinance. And we talked last time about asking VSP to help us enforce that as well. So that's also part of, I don't know if that should be written into the contract or that's just a simple phone call as you did, Emily.
Well, I can certainly ask her to give us the records of the kind of spot stops and where they, if they're making stops, and what kind of services they are providing other than just the hours. I'm sure she knows that, or they know that up yep. there. I don't think there's any question. We haven't asked for it. I don't think but what we would get that kind of response if we asked for it. We haven't asked. And so I don't think that's a problem. And it isn't probably part of the contract. And I think that they probably would enforce anything that we asked them to if that's what we told them, that's where we wanted them to concentrate. We haven't done that in the past, but I don't think that's necessarily their fault. They have stopped people on Howe Hill in the evenings before, but you don't see them here as often as you might. That being said, with this construction going on, although the construction people were quite disappointed that people were speeding by them and the road was supposed to be closed and they were traveling at a high rate of speed and putting their people in jeopardy. So, and I don't know whether after Jimmy talked to them, whether there was any state police activity up this road or not. I can't say. I don't know.
They did go up there and I know a lot of the residents on that road have asked me that, you know, it's going to be a racetrack. And I did have a conversation with one of the cops there not too long ago that we're going to have to start setting up here because that was an accident over there today. A woman went off straight off the road and clipped a pole off. And then a couple of days ago, I guess, there was another one that went off the road on Howe Hill. And left their car and the whole deal. So there's a lot of citizens up there that are really concerned on the speed factor. So I think it would be a really good thing to have them up there for a while.
So we can ask them that as well. Anybody ready to vote on this contract of $21,647.34. And that's the estimated total cost. I have a feeling they did not quite use up the estimated total cost in this last year, but I would have to check Ellen's books to know that for sure. Is everybody ready for the vote?
Yep.
All those in favor, John?
Aye.
Chuck?
Aye.
Steve?
Aye.
Scott?
Aye.
Emily? Aye. End of state police contract. Next on the agenda.
Emily, just quickly.
Yes.
You mentioned that you're not sure what the balance was. We had spent about $15,000 by the middle of June out of a budget of $22,000, so there was money left over there.
Great, that's good. I didn't think they were using it all. So we could ask for more service as well. Now we have to vote on the recommendation for Frank Perrin to be the forest fire warden for Pomfret for 5 more years. That's a 5-year term. I did reach out to Frank, and he said that he would take it for another 5 years unless someone else had a burning desire, and I did not recognize his pun at first, to do it, or we had a burning desire to put someone else in there. And my feeling was, if Frank wanted to do it, that would be a good thing. So he is willing to take another 5-year term. I need a motion to approve the recommendation of the Forest Service to appoint him in that position.
So moved.
Can one of you be a second?
Second.
I'll second it.
Yep.
Okay. Any discussion?
I have a question. We probably don't have control over it, but I've received several comments that when people call for burning permits, that they don't get anybody, and they're just leaving messages and so forth. So I don't know if that's something that we can directly talk to Frank about, or how we go about handling that. But that kind of seems like an issue to me.
Yeah, that does. This is Chuck. A couple of times I've called Frank and he wasn't there, but he almost always records a message that he leaves that says either today is a day that, yes, you can burn, just leave a message and tell me who you are and where you're burning. Or he leaves a message saying this is not a day that you can burn. So I think that he generally does that. So
that's been his MO. But I know what you're talking about, Steve. I mean, it's certainly something we can mention to him. But just as Chuck is saying, the couple of times I've burned in recent history, last couple of years, I did what Chuck just described, where I called and listened to the message, whether it's a day that you can burn, and then just left the details. And what I usually do with Frank is I call and again later and follow up with him just to let him know when I've stopped burning too, or when the fire's about out. So just sort of closing the loop on it. But I get your point, Steve, about the, just making sure that the communication happens.
Yeah, and it sounds like maybe he's trying to do that because he can't always be there.
Yeah, I think he's just trying to make it easier for people.
Well, the other thing too is that when I discussed, and this was on another matter, I saw Kevin Rice, and he had a problem with the barn burning, or parts of the barn burning down behind what used to be Big's house. And Spencer Swank had taken the barn down, or someone had, and he was burning up the remnants or whatever. And whether he left the fire going or not, nobody, that was not part of the discussion. That was not a known factor. But the fire rekindled, and the fire department got called out. Spencer was in his homeland in bed asleep, and the fire department had to go get him to come back and attend to his fire. And so what Kevin suggested was that in Barnard, for instance, if you get a fire permit, it is explicitly you are told you can burn this fire today. By the end of the day, this fire has to be put out, and you have to stay and attend to it until it is put out. And given that the fire department gets called out on these things, if these fires rekindle themselves and no one's taking care of them, perhaps we should make Frank aware that, or maybe we should make some kind of decision that at the end of the day, the fire has to be out and it cannot be left unattended all night long, continuing to burn. And so that was Kevin's concern. And I don't think that was so much concern about Frank and what he was doing as a forest fire warden, but the fact that these fires are being allowed to continue to burn with no one watching them. And at the end of the day, they should be out. And so we might want to make that kind of stipulation. But in the meanwhile, I still think that we need to, his term is up, and we need to sign off on this recommendation.
And that's part of the concern of with this as well is that I think there needs to be, and whether we just give Frank a call and have him attend a meeting by Zoom or however, but there needs to be more communication between Frank and the fire department too. So when these permits do get issued, we don't have volunteer people that have limited time to volunteer to begin with chasing fires that have permits.
Well, that is true. That is true. And what has happened in the past is that the dispatcher down in Woodstock doesn't know that someone has a burn permit and there's a fire going and someone drives by and says something's on fire and they send out the crew. And so that is also another issue as well.
And I'm sure they can all be worked out as long as we have a meeting with Frank. But these are issues that are important issues to get resolved, I think.
My suggestion would be to somebody to contact dispatch and see if they're willing, first of all, because the notification process is a problem. The way it works in Woodstock is the fire chief there is the forest fire warden, which they don't need to be. I'm not suggesting that. But the first time you want to burn, you have to go into the station down there and fill out a form that's got your name and address and all your contact information and stuff. And then after that, the forest fire warden decides on a daily basis or however he does it or when it changes, he notifies dispatch as to whether you can burn or not. And you call up dispatch and they look your information up. They know you're registered and they say, yes, you can burn today. And so they know everybody that's burning within Woodstock. I don't know if they'd be willing to do that for us as well. We do pay them for dispatch fees. So, because if somebody calls Frank and leaves a message on the machine and he's gone all day.
No one's going to get told. That's just it.
That's right. So nobody knows if they got a permit or not. So if there was some kind of it works with Woodstock with dispatch because there's always somebody there.
So we just need to work out a communication process, it sounds.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But that's
so I think maybe a discussion with Frank is in order.
Yes.
But we still need to vote on this recommendation. And so I would suggest, unless there's any more discussion, we vote on the motion at hand, which was to take the recommendation and of the Forest Service and suggest that they do indeed reappoint Frank. All those in favor? John?
Aye.
Chuck?
Aye.
Steve?
Aye.
Scott?
Aye.
And myself, aye. Okay, moving on, conflict of interest policy.
I thought we had done that last week.
No, folks wanted to take a little bit more time just to look it over.
Okay.
I have a couple of questions. And on your new policy, there is, on the old policy, there is an Article 8 which you no longer have in there that is called public assertion. where, and this says there may be an occur instances where a member of the public asserts that a public officer has conflict of interest, real or perceived, in a particular matter. In such an instance, the member of the public shall make their assertion known to the Pomfret Select Board and the public officer in question at a public meeting. The public officer in question shall then follow the procedure for determining if a conflict of interest exists, as outlined in Article 5. And I wondered why you took that out, Scott.
I didn't take it out intentionally. I'm trying to pull up the old one. If it is out, it's not by intent. It's an omission. So I didn't intentionally take that out. It might have just been a typo. I'm pulling up the old one now. What article is this, Emily? 8?
It's Article 8.
Okay. I didn't pull that out intentionally. So that's just a drafting omission. So it should go back in there.
Okay. And then let me see. At the beginning of a document, let me just pull, I've got to get back here. You changed the definitions with conflict of interest may mean anything of the following. And this list shall not serve to restrict or limit the definition of what constitutes a conflict of interest. Such conflict of interest may be actual, i.e. existing in fact, or perceived, i.e. regarded by such as an outside party. I wondered why you took that out. You went to definitions. That's under Article 3, definitions.
Okay, hang on. Let me catch up with you here. In which line item?
Under A, our conflict of interest.
Yeah, under A, which one? A 1, 2, 3?
It was under A before 1, 2, or 3.
Okay, I didn't, that doesn't sound like a change I made.
It's in this revised conflict of interest policy. A conflict of interest on your revised policy says includes but is not limited to any of the following. And in the conflict of interest policy that we adopted on October 4, 2017, it says conflict of interest may mean any of the following. However, this list does not serve to restrict or limit the definition of what constitutes a conflict of interest. Such a conflict of interest may be actual, i.e. existing in fact, or perceived, i.e. regarded as such by an outside party. And the reason later on in the document, there is reference to both either a actual or a perceived conflict of interest. And it would seem to me that if you're going to have it in the later part of the document, then it also should be addressed in the definitions. And so that's why I'm asking why it is not in this.
I didn't make that change either. I think what happened, Emily, is somewhere in the time that the conflict of interest policy got adopted back in whenever it was, I don't know what date it was, but Mike was still on the board.
It was October 4, 2017.
Okay. So I think what happened, Emily, is that sometime between 2017 and what I sent out last time, there were probably some edits made on the version out on SharePoint, because that change that you just described, I didn't make that. Actually, the language you're quoting from the original actually sounds better to me than what I'm seeing now.
Well, I think it's important that if you're going to use those terms later in the document, they be here under definitions. And so because they're not there, and I'm not disputing whether you took them out or someone else did, but they aren't there. And so my point is I think it should be there. And so we should have under conflict of interest for the we should put that back in there.
Yep.
Under
I agree.
A, and then go down with your other definitions, which appear to be the same. And
yep, I agree. I think you're right. And so thanks for catching that. I totally agree with you.
Also, when that public assertion goes back in there under Article 8, then Article 8 will become 9 and 9 will become 10. And then you're going to have to change some wording under Article 9 and get those numbers correct. And so all of those things are going to have to be changed before we adopt the document.
Yeah.
In my view, anyway.
Well, you're right. You're absolutely right. So I agree with all those changes.
Are there any other changes that or concerns that anyone else had?
I'd like to chime in if I could. So I think part of the confusion of what you're talking about, if you look at what's on for the proposed to be voted on this week, it says Article 3 definition. And then the next line is number 1, conflict of interest. And I think that's supposed to be the A. And then
that's
the subsection beneath that is number 1. So
I
don't know if anyone else is looking at it at the time.
I am looking at it, and I think you're absolutely right.
Subheading for each indentation that you would have there. And the only other thing that I was concerned about was that it mentions down at the end, Article 12B. The last sentence there is the Pomfret Select Board may choose to remove an appointed officer subject to the state law. I must have written down the wrong thing. It mentions at some point that if somebody is accused of a conflict of interest, there are various ways that that can be discussed. It can be done in an executive session. There can be discussion in a public meeting with the Select Board saying that they think that the person's conflict of interest is legitimate and they shouldn't have been voting on something. And I guess I'm just wondering if there should be something there that talks about multiple events. If somebody, because it specifically says that they could be asked to leave the Select Board, but they cannot be forced to leave the Select Board. But if somebody
Ellen, this provision you're describing doesn't apply to Select Board members. Select Board members are elected, not appointed. This only talks about appointed officers.
So does that mean that if a Select Board member repeatedly acts, even though there has been an identified conflict of interest, that there is no public discussion or no hand slapping of somebody who votes, even though they've got a clear conflict of interest?
There can certainly be a public discussion about it, and there can certainly be actions taken, but you just talked about removal, and there's no provision. Select Board elected officials, not just Select Board members, but elected officials, there's no power in the conflict of interest policy or even under state law to remove elected officials. But certainly, to your point, Ellen, there can be a discussion about it and there can be actions taken, but there's no removal provision.
Yes, I just think it's unfortunate that if the Select Board ends up with somebody that repeatedly steps over the line on some of these things, that there isn't an escalating reaction to that kind of behavior and betrayal of the public trust.
We also have a personnel policy. And so there's a, and the Select Board the select board, so only the personnel policy is kind of tricky in that it applies only to either elected officials who voluntarily subject themselves to it, or the select board, of course. But there are, I think there are some things outlined, perhaps, I haven't looked at the personnel policy in a while, that part of the personnel policy, but there may be some things in the personnel policy that might answer what you're describing, Ellen.
Part of my concern grows out of experience that I had with a family member who was on a planning commission in another part of Vermont, where there were people on the select board who were realtors who were involved in development and other things of that nature. So there's a comment at the beginning where Article 3, Number 3, I think it says, in the setting of fees that somebody on the select board or a public official could be paying the same fee as the public, as in tax rates and things of that nature. But when it comes to zoning fees or other transactional fees, I guess I would say, if someone is involved in significant development and would be incurring those fees on a multiple basis, maybe one fee is no big deal, but multiple fees for development could be significant, and that could sway someone's vote. So I guess I was thinking that I would add something there about, a one-time fee is no big deal, and it probably is insignificant, but when fees could be enacted a number of times, they could add up to something that could really cause a real conflict of interest over the cost of it. And there's nothing to address that in this.
Yeah, well, I mean, the changes, aside from the omissions that Emily has pointed out, the only edits that were intended to be made here are those that are mandated by the federal government through our sub-grant process under FEMA. So the kinds of things you're describing, Ellen, are not part of the scope of the changes. It doesn't mean we shouldn't take it up, but that it's I guess what I would say is that if we want to go down the path of looking more carefully at the conflict of interest policy fee for other things besides just getting the language in line with what were required by the federal government, then that would probably require a couple of other times to get it on the agenda and to discuss those things. But we're kind of off course here a little bit with what the scope of what the changes we're trying to make. These changes.
You're right. I forgot that was intended for the grants.
Yeah, this is just to get us up to speed for grants.
Okay,
So the question that I have is then, you received that letter from the gentleman that did your, not audit, but like an audit regarding the FEMA work that you did. And the suggestion there was to change this conflict of interest policy in certain areas. And did you do those changes?
Yes,
in this current rendition?
Absolutely. Those changes are in there. The things we've been talking about are truly unintended omissions. So I will, put in Article 8. I don't know how that, I pulled a version off of SharePoint, so it could be a version issue, but I'll put that back in and clean up Article 3. But otherwise, the only other changes are related to what's required by the federal government for the grant process. And, the upshot of these changes, is under Article 9. And this is something we talked about last time. Article 9 in the draft we're looking at here. There was a voluntary kind of recusal provision, but under the federal guidelines, there's no voluntary recusal. It's a mandatory recusal. And the other major change is that it applies not just to a public officials, but this conflict of interest applies to employees, officers, or agents of the town. And that was the other, significant change.
So I guess the bottom line is we need to get the changes, the inadvertent changes put back in, and then we can vote to adopt this at the next meeting.
Yeah.
When we have a copy that's correct.
Yeah. Why don't I get those corrections made? And thank you again for pointing those out, and we'll tee it up for next time. And
okay, next meeting.
I'll make sure I was just assuming it was a carbon copy of what's out on the website. Obviously it's not.
Okay. Does anyone have a problem with that decision or agreement? Don't everybody speak at once? I guess not. Personnel policy changes. I did not put this on. I assume you did, Scott, or someone else did.
I did.
And I assume if you haven't read it in a while, you have nothing for us to look at this particular moment.
No, I didn't intend. The only intent I had for tonight was just to refresh everybody's memory. Even Chuck, you've not heard this before, but the extent to what I wanted to talk about tonight was do we want to take this up again? We contemplated but never made a number of changes in the personnel policy. A lot of those were around sick leave, vacation time, and some other. There was also some things that Jill Muir from VLCT suggested that we make in terms of language and employee stuff. So, Chuck, I don't know if you ever got that email thread. I'll have to check from Jill, but everybody else should have that email thread from Jill. But basically what I'm proposing here, if people are amenable to it, is that it's been a couple of years now, and that we take the personnel policy changes up again. Because I know Jim's not here anymore, but just for instance, one of the things that we talked about doing was having combined time off rather than separated vacation, sick leave, and all of that just makes more challenging to manage. And that we would just move to what a lot of organizations are doing out there, which is just a combined time off policy. So those are the nature of the kinds of things that we talked about a couple of years ago, but never acted on. And so I'm just wondering if there's an interest in going back and trying to actually make some of those changes.
There's also some inconsistencies in the policy.
Yep.
That probably should be addressed as well.
Yep.
That we know are there, but we have not addressed.
Yep. Those two.
So I would be in agreement to take that up at some point. I'd like to get, I think that's going to be, I'd like to get the conflict of interest policy done first, because I think that personnel policy is going to take us a while, but I think we should refresh our memories and read it and take it up soon. Now that would be my feeling only. Other board members, anybody want to discuss it or have input?
I think Scott.
Anybody got their hand up? What did you say, Steve?
I think Scott brought up some good back information there. Kind of got slipped through the cracks.
Well, we've meant to get it done and we haven't, but
yeah.
We still can.
Yep.
So I think we should put that on the agenda for a future meeting. Any more discussion on this item right now? Karen, are you here for your certificate of compliance and your other items that we included in the package?
I am.
So why don't you give us your scoop?
So I sent a letter to the select board on June 23rd for two things. One, with the new zoning bylaws, one of the requirements for any permit for a ZBA or a planning commission, any conditional use permit, would be you would need to do a certificate of compliance. The town of Pomfret does not have a one of these permits at all. So with the help of Ben Brickner, we drafted up one to submit to the select board for approval to be able to use. Basically, that would be when the applicant has finished the job of, or with a permit, then they need to fill out a certificate of compliance, submit it to me, and then I would go and see and do a checklist. Did they do what they said they were going to do for this on the permit? And then basically check to see if they're in compliance to what they said that they were going to do. And then this is in turn filed in the land records because it is a conditional use permit and they run with the land no matter the owner. So we just need to have one to be able to do the public. I do have had three, I believe, that we will need these once they finish their permit and what they apply for. And then the other would be to revisit the fees that last was done in 2010. Things have increased in cost to recording fees and recording surveys and ads in the paper. More often than not, the town of Pomfret, when we have a hearing, is spending money for the permit because we aren't getting the permit fee doesn't accommodate for what it costs to do it. So I was just suggesting that the select board looks that and maybe possibly revisit with the fees. Specifically, the certificate of compliance fee, we do not have one stipulated.
Karen sent you all this email and I told her we'd put it on the agenda for the next meeting. And so you have that, you have the old permit fee schedule that was in 2010. And we need to come up to snuff and get it so that at least the applicant is paying their way and we're not subsidizing applicants for these permits.
Hey, Karen, have you looked out there as to what, to get an idea of what what the going rate is in some other towns? Like,
I did for the certificate of compliance. I did look at six different towns for those fees. I did not look at what it would cost for hearings and what it would cost for any of that.
Okay.
But I can. I can do some research and do look at other towns, but I only specifically focus on a certificate of compliance fee.
No, that's okay. I was just curious. I don't want to make work for you, but I was just curious if you had done any. We can do that, I think.
I did talk to Becky and Ellen in regarding to costs, and I did detail it in the letter to the select board on the 23rd. That recording in the land records has gone up to $15 per page, and it costs $25 to record a survey. So if you have a land record, if you have like, say, a permit for the planning commission or the zoning that goes in the land record, and it's 4 to 5 pages, it's, you know, $15 a page. So it does get kind of costly, and the fee right now is $135. To do a conditional use permit, either before the planning commission or the ZBA. And that's not covering the land records and submitting surveys and the hearing costs and everything else. So the town is paying money for people to submit permits.
Well, we can, I would suggest that we can at least adopt the certificate of compliance tonight, but I think we'll have to do some homework on the fees.
Yeah, the fees, that was more of a, I think that we should probably relook at that. It wasn't something need to be adopted tonight.
Right.
It was more of a, you know, we should probably look at it.
Yep.
So do we have a motion on this certificate of compliance then?
I move that the board adopt instituting a certificate of compliance for conditional use approval permits.
We really, the zoning ordinance has already said that they must obtain the certificate of compliance. So really, we're just approving the document.
Right, you're just approving the permit that I drafted up.
Right, we're just approving the form.
Yeah,
that's correct. Because the zoning regulation says they must have one. We just are approving this form that Karen gave us, if that's what we wish to do. Is that what your motion wished to say?
Yes, that's what I meant to say with my motion.
Okay. Do we have a second for that motion?
Second. Sure.
Is there any more discussion? All those then in favor of Karen's certificate of compliance, signify by saying aye. John?
Aye.
Chuck?
Aye.
Steve?
Aye.
Scott?
Aye.
And myself, aye. Okay, and Karen, we thank you for coming on this matter. We will do something regarding the fees and get a little more information. Is there anything else you need to talk to us about?
No, I'm all set.
Thank you for coming, Karen.
Thank you.
Town hall rental. I sent to you all Barnard has just redone their, they've just sent out new fees and whatever and guidelines for the town hall, their town hall rental, and I sent those out to you. Right now, as far as COVID-19 is concerned, we can, or individuals can, have 50% of the approved fire safety recommended number of people in a building. There is also guidance for catering and food services. And I included those with that notification from the Barnard rental application. I personally think that if we want to rent the hall, that the people that rent it are going to have to be responsible for the being in compliance with the COVID-19 regulations. They're kind of a moving target, but I have a feeling I'm just guessing they're not going to change much, that we probably won't open up too much more. I was interested in seeing the Barnard Town Hall rental policy and the agreement. It's much more significant than ours. And I also was surprised to see that they only rent to a legal resident or a taxpayer. And so I guess the town hall thing is now up for discussion. I have not touched base with Passive to see what our coverage is going to be regarding any issues with COVID-19, but I will do that. I've got some rainy days ahead still.
You put that in.
you put that in before?
Are
signing in or because your password has expired. Okay, so now you can put a password in.
We've got some background noise going on.
Are you not muted?
Somebody's not muted. Are we taking a fresh look at our application form and wanting to potentially beef it up, or are we just wanting to make sure that we amend or include or whatever we want to say the COVID-19 parameters, and that along with our current application, we just need to put some language or have Becky, when someone rents, make sure she instructs them that they need to follow. Yeah, I'm not sure exactly what we're trying to accomplish tonight. Sounds like maybe we might want to, I know Chuck had originally asked whether we want to do it at all. And I think the answer is yes, but we want to do it and make sure that folks are following the guidelines. We have to do it that way. But are we also trying to come up with a new application form too?
Not necessarily. I included that because they have come out with a new application form. The COVID guidelines are there. I thought it would be something that would be of interest to us. I think that we have not, I think in today's situation, we may want to be more careful than we have in the past. That is a board decision. I threw this out to you because it came when we were discussing it, and or we were going to have to discuss it, and that was another piece of input that I thought we might want to consider. I'm not necessarily thinking we should redo the application. I'm not necessarily thinking that we shouldn't. I think that if we have to start having professional cleaners come in there after each event that might or might not happen there to make sure that everything is sanitary and disinfected between each rental and those kinds of things, then it's going to cost us more to do that. I don't think necessarily that you would be able to expect that the renter themselves would do that necessarily. And so I think we need to make some decisions as to what our parameters might be for renting the town hall, given the COVID-19 situation, which is changing things somewhat for all of us. That's why I put it in there. This is a board decision. We can do you, and I'm open to any decisions. I thought it was, we're just dealing with different parameters, and I think it should be a board decision as to how we want to handle that.
To me, the only thing that might need to be appended or included as a set of instructions from Becky, because we already have in the application, there's already language in there about leaving it in a clean condition under 7 and 8. But we may want to have, along with when Becky approves an application, not only have her provide the COVID-19 links to the guidance, just as Barnard does, but also to, I think the one thing we would want to make sure renters do is that they not just leave it clean, but they clean it according to what's required for COVID-19, so that we don't have to take on that responsibility and take on that cost. Alternatively, we do take on that responsibility and the cost, but we shift the cost of that to the renter. I think one of those two would be okay.
The problem is I see it, and that's from an individual point of view, but thinking of the town as a whole, as I have seen this COVID thing come along, different people have different ideas about how careful they need to be, how they should disinfect whatever they do, whether they choose to wear masks or they don't, whether they choose to quarantine themselves when they come back from wherever they've been for the winter. All of these things are personal decisions, but we are a government entity that is renting out a building, and we should not be necessarily assuming that any of those renters are going to clean and disinfect that building and the touchable surfaces in that building the way they should be cleaned to make them COVID-19 acceptable.
Okay.
And so now this is a personal opinion, and you all can disagree, and I'm game for that as well. So that puts us in a predicament where if we need to be sure that it is going to be cleaned in an appropriate fashion and disinfected properly, then that means that we have to get a cleaning service in there, a professional cleaning service in there to do that. And I don't want to see our townspeople paying for a limited rental income that puts us in the bind financially to pay more to get it cleaned professionally and
You're
for the next individual that rents. You follow?
Yeah, so that's what I was saying, Emily, is one of the options is to simply shift the cost of that to
just grab a piece of paper from that.
And we can hire somebody to do the cleaning properly, but that the renter would be obligated to pay for that. So there would be an added fee to the rental for making sure that it's cleaned the right way.
There are also web meetings where you can ask questions, and it may be that if the town hall sits there for a week or 2 weeks unused, that no disinfection would be necessary, that the shelf life, so to speak, or half life or complete life of the COVID-19 would be gone in, say, 3 days or 4 days or 5 days. And so it may be a moot point. I have those places to go to, and I can ask those questions. I have not done that, but that might also benefit us in that the town hall is only used perhaps once a week, once every 2 weeks, once a month, something like that, where those viruses cannot sustain themselves that long without a host.
Yeah, that's a good point.
So we can, and I don't have that information today, but I think I can get that. I was doing some research today, and there are places where those questions can be asked, and I will also ask the passive people. But at the very best, it's my understanding that the fire marshal has only approved that building for 101 or two people. And so that's going to be, if it's going to be half the capacity, we're only talking a 50 people venue at the very most. And then there was also language in there that indicated that because of social distancing and everything, people would have to be seated. And so there's no way that we can enforce something like that. If you were to have a wedding there, people would not necessarily be seated. They would not necessarily be social distancing. And I don't know whether we want to get into that or not, but these are some of the guidelines that they are discussing with restaurants and things. And there are also specific guidelines for caterers that have to be followed. And we may not necessarily be responsible for those guidelines, but we're responsible if we're going to rent the building several times during the summer. We're responsible for having it in an acceptable condition when the next person rents it.
So I guess, I mean, obviously there are some risks to allowing it to be rented. The easy thing to do would be not to rent it, and then we avoid a lot of this. But so I guess that raises the question of how, what's the demand like, and how, you know, do we want to provide that option for the public to use that space, even if the demand's not high, or do we just close it up and wait until, and not use it at all, and wait until the coast is clear until we use it again? I mean, it's there's obviously a risk calculation here, but I guess the big question is, do we even want to open it up? And if we do, then we there's obviously a number of things we're going to have to do to make that possible. But the easy thing would be to keep it closed.
Well, what do the other board members think regarding the situation? Steve?
Have we had any interest at this point?
Someone asked Chuck.
Right. That's how this got started, was somebody, I think, had approached Chuck, right, Chuck?
We had a hand up. Kathy had her hand up.
It was Kathy? My hand, but Steve just asked the question. I was just wondering if anyone had actually contacted Becky, and also how much money you actually make every year off renting the town hall.
It's not a moneymaker, that's for sure.
So it would seem to me, if no one's asked Becky and it's not a moneymaker, that at this point, it's probably easier, considering all the work that sounds like it's going into it, that you might consider not renting it at all. But I guess you could take it up again if someone asked about it, seeing as how most of the time for a wedding or something, it's not, I asked today and I need it tomorrow. But that's just my opinion, and I'm not on the board, but I just wanted to share that.
This is Ellen. $450 on renting the town hall last year.
Thank you, Ellen. John, what is your feeling?
I mean, I don't know as though we would be responsible if something happened. We can't be the police, but, you know, even if you have 50 people in there, it's seated and they don't move, you're still not going to probably be 6 feet from each other, which there was a whole conversation on VPR Vermont edition last week about this, and somebody trying to argue with whoever at the state and of why they selected the fire capacity of a building, because 50% of that still in that building, you're still going to be 3 feet from one another. So that's certainly an issue. I don't know. I like Barnard's, where they only let it out to residents of the town. You know, I don't know as though we would do that long term, but I would think if we did open it up to rental now, that I would restrict it to people from Pomfret. At this point, it is a community asset, but I mean, if we're only making $450 a year, that seems hardly worth it to deal with that. What is our rental fee?
It depends on whether or not they use the kitchen. It might be $100 just to use the room, and maybe $150 if they need the kitchen facilities too.
What are your thoughts, Chuck?
Chuck, you're muted.
Okay. Yeah. I don't know. All right.
I did see, well, it wasn't about a town hall. It was for some other gathering. I don't know if it was required because wasn't site specific. It was something I saw about somebody's wedding. And if they didn't have the guest list in by a certain date, then you weren't coming. I think they probably had to have some kind of a submittal, so wherever they were going knew who was coming and the number of people prior, so there weren't any last minute show ups. But yeah, it's tricky.
Well, why don't I see if I can get some information from Passive regarding any liabilities that we might have, and perhaps I can go on one of those question forms with that's from the Office of Community and something Commerce or Community Development, and see if I can get a couple answers regarding how long the hall would have to sit without being with no disinfection, where there would be limited risk, and we can bring this up and make a final decision at the next meeting.
Sounds good.
Yeah, I wondered
everybody
about
happy
that
with
too.
That?
Yeah, I wondered about how long the place would have to sit idle with nobody being in there before it was considered safe.
Well, there was something that I read some time ago, and it's been a while, that, for instance, they felt that the virus would be viable on pasteboard for a day. It would be viable on stainless steel for 3 days, and there were various surfaces that virus would stay viable on. And it would seem to me that if you're talking 3 days, like for stainless steel, that if you didn't have anyone in there for a week, you might have no risk at all. And so in that case, if you only rented it once a week, you would not have to be nearly as fastidious about the disinfectant of every surface as you would if you were going to be there every day. The other thing is that one of the things that CDC and or the state is recommending is, for instance, if you use toilet facilities, they should be disinfected after every use. Are we going to have someone in the hall, a janitor of sorts, doing that kind of activity? And so there's some questions that need to be asked that we don't have the answers for, and maybe I can find them before the next meeting. But I think at this point we don't have an answer. Moving on, the next thing is ATV dirt bike ordinance. And someone's going to have to speak to this other than me, because I didn't put this on.
Well, we had, I think we had talked about, and Emily, I believe from the minutes, you might have made a call about having VSP take a stroll up.
And I did with the email exchange that I had with Barb Kessler. I did indeed tell her there was some issues there with dirt bikes, and they were unregistered, and we did not know who they belonged to, but they were going up and down Bartlett Brook at a high rate of speed, and perhaps she could send her trooper up that road on occasion, and she did not indicate that she would not do that, but that contract, I think, came last week. The exchange with her occurred last week, and I do not know whether they have gotten up there, but I did suggest that to her in the email.
So I think we were, if I recall correctly, we were going to talk more about whether we wanted VSP's assistance in enforcing the ordinance more broadly. And as I mentioned during the agenda review, the other thing that occurred to me when I read the ordinance is that it doesn't specifically say that it covers dirt bikes, but you could, and this is a decision the board would have to make, but we could under the definitions of the ordinance. So let me just bring it up here.
That's what I was thinking too, Scott. If you made it under the definitions and could say, you know, here on after known as ATVs, but any, you know,
right,
three or four wheeled vehicles that are not registered and road legal, because there's nothing we can do about a registered road legal dirt bike other than police speeding and things like that. But
right. So under the definition section, under the definition of ATV, because if you think about it, a dirt bike really could be an ATV of sorts, I think.
Right.
Means any non-highway recreational vehicle except snowmobiles when used for cross-country travel on trails or any of the following or combination thereof: land, water, snow, ice, marsh, swampland, and natural terrain. So it's, I think, and you guys might have better sense of this, but it's possible that dirt bikes could be inclusive under the definition of ATV. But I think we would want to make an official interpretation of that to say, for purposes of enforcing our ATV and snowmobile ordinance, Section 3C covers dirt bikes, you know, and just so that we're making that clear.
Well, yes, but unregistered dirt bikes aren't supposed to be on traveled right-of-ways.
That's what he's saying, that if it's unregistered or an unroad legal dirt bike, that it would be considered an ATV and therefore subject to the ATV ordinance.
And I think just kind of Googling this, I think dirt bikes, and I haven't done any sort of extensive research here, but some people might say dirt bikes are ATVs, others might not. And that's why I'm raising this, is we could easily say as a select board, for purposes of enforcement, ATV, you know, 3C under our definition section includes dirt bikes. And then we're covered, rather than having to amend the ordinance, we could just make an interpretation of it. That's the simplest.
Well, if you're going to call a dirt bike an ATV, they're banned from town highways. So
that's correct. But that's exactly my point, Emily, is that
if they're registerable, we cannot exclude them from a town highway. And if they're not registered, regardless of this ATV situation, they're not supposed to be on the town highway. That's state law. We don't have to enforce a law and add them to our ordinance if they already shouldn't be there according to state law.
Well, I guess the question is, you get ATV plates for a dirt bike that would make it legal for off-road use, because four-wheelers and stuff are in some towns are legal on secondary roads, but they still, by state law, they still have to have a registration through the state to be able to be used on that road. So I guess that would be, can you put an ATV plate on a dirt bike that's not road legal but would make it trail legal? And then you would want to make sure that it was in the ATV policy, because the state says it's up to the individual towns as to whether you let ATVs on your secondary town road. So,
well, let me ask you something else, or let's before we go any further with the snowmobile and ATV ordinance, do we want to allow unregistered dirt bikes as an ATV, if you get them an ATV plate or not? Do you want them on secondary or paved public roads.
Well, as of right now, ATVs are not allowed. So.
Right. That's
right. And neither are dirt bikes unless they're registered. Do we want to change that?
That's kind of what I'm saying, is that the way we would change it is by interpreting our ordinance to include dirt bikes. And then by doing that, ATVs are treated, dirt bikes are then treated the same way as ATVs.
Yes, but you're missing my point. A dirt bike, an unregistered dirt bike, should not be on a public right of way already.
I'm not missing that point. It's
so we don't need to call them an ATV because they're not supposed to be there anyway.
Right, but what we're talking about is enforcing a town ordinance, right?
No, you're missing my point. By state law, they're an unregistered dirt bike. By state law, should not be on a public right of way.
I'm not missing your point, Emily.
So we don't need to. They already are illegal on a public road. So we don't need to have them be part of our ATV ordinance because they are already not lawful. If they're unregistered, they're not lawful on a public right of way.
Right, but the point I understand what you're saying, Emily, but the point I'm trying to make is that if we also want to bring into the enforcement of our ATV and snowmobile ordinance, we would need to include dirt bikes into the ordinance. So you're talking about enforcing state law about a non-registered dirt bike, and being on a town highway. That's a registration. You're talking about some sort of state violation. I'm talking about our town ordinance. And if the question that was originally raised is, do we want the Vermont State Police to help us enforce our town ordinance? And if we do want VSP to help us enforce our town ordinance, then that means we would also need to pull into the scope of the ordinance dirt bikes.
But would the state police actually be enforcing our ordinance or enforcing the state law?
They would be enforcing our ordinance. It says it under Section 10, enforcement. The Pomfret Selectmen.
Right, but if the state trooper came and went up Bartlett Brook and there was an unregistered dirt bike going down the Bartlett Brook, he is going to issue them a ticket under traffic violations. Not necessarily our ordinance, correct?
He could do both. So if a Vermont state trooper pulls over a dirt bike rider, that officer may cite the rider not only for a violation of state law, but may also cite that person for a violation of Pomfret Town ordinance. And but we can't have that, we wouldn't be able to do that unless we declared as a matter of interpretation that dirt bikes are included within our ordinance.
But does it matter?
It does matter, because we would need, somebody could argue, well, wait a minute, the Vermont State Trooper cited me $25 for a first offense under the town's ATV and snowmobile ordinance, but it doesn't say anything about dirt bikes.
But that, he wouldn't if it's not in there. He would,
I know, but
he would cite them under state law.
I know. So I keep coming back to the same place. Do we want dirt bikes to be subject to our town ordinance?
I don't get it. I don't see why.
I don't see why we have to if they're already subject to state law, which says they shouldn't be there.
Right. Because So a dirt bike rider could, in theory, be subject to both a state violation and a town violation. That is the question.
Okay, but why?
Why not? Why, if you want to stop the behavior, why wouldn't you subject them to the town ordinance?
Well, I would assume that the state law would be effective and the violation and the fine would be effective. You mean, so this way we could fine them twice and.
Yeah, they would be cited for not only, whatever the state violation is, which I have no idea.
Yeah, I get what you're saying. They would be cited for two different violations. Correct. But I just don't see the point.
Okay.
I don't see why it's necessary.
Okay. Then it sounds like we're not.
We don't need to do it.
Okay. Well, this whole conversation started as a question about whether we wanted dirt bikes.
I can help answer some questions with using Google here. In Vermont, ATVs are not considered, or dirt bikes are not considered ATVs. So you cannot get an ATV plate on a dirt bike. So you won't run into a problem with somebody having a dirt bike with an ATV plate. So therefore, it either is registered as a road legal vehicle or it is not. So if it is not, it's not legal to be used anywhere except for one's own property. And if it is, then it's legal to be used on the roads. So
is the only thing we care about unregistered dirt bikes? Is that the only issue we care about? Or do we care about dirt bikes in general?
We can't legally do anything about a legally registered roadworthy dirt bike other than if they're disturbing the peace or speeding. If they've got plates and an inspection sticker, they're legal to go anywhere a car is. So
is that true? Because I'm looking at the ordinance now.
They're either plated with a motorcycle plate like any other motorcycle, or they're not legal to get one because they don't have whatever features that would make it so.
But looking at our town ordinance, even if an ATV is registered, they are banned from town highways.
Correct, because you can register an ATV with ATV plates, which means that you're legal to ride on trails. And it's
right.
Under Vermont law, it's up to the individual towns as to whether you let them on some or all of your secondary roads. But they don't need a inspection sticker or a vehicle plate. It's an ATV plate, but you can't put an ATV plate on a dirt bike. It has to be a highway legal plate.
Understood, but no ATVs, registered or otherwise, are permitted to be on town highways, period. That's what the ordinance says.
That is what it says, yes.
So the question I have for the board is, does the board want the same result for dirt bikes, registered or not? Do we want dirt bikes on town highways?
If they're registered,
you cannot
do about it.
Yes, you can.
No, you cannot exclude them. If they are registered and roadworthy, they have every right to be on a town road, just as does a three-wheeled motorcycle or a car or a truck or anything else. If they are an unregistered dirt bike and they are on a public town highway or state highway, they are breaking the state law and they are illegal. It doesn't matter what the town wants or doesn't want. It is a state issue. If they are registered, they are legal, just like any other motorized vehicle on a town road. That is what we sign on to when we take state money for these roads. If they are not registered and they are not inspectable and they are not registered, they are not to be on a public right-of-way. That is a state law, and that is a state situation that they can take care of it for us The state police can do that if we ask them and say, we're having a problem here. But we cannot exclude registered dirt bikes from these town roads.
I think we can.
No, you can't.
Yeah,
I had a hand up if you want to do that.
Who had the hand up?
Kathy.
It was me, but it doesn't necessarily matter. But unless you want to do something like the town of Woodstock, where you stop them at the border because you don't want to let them on paved roads, and you make them get a special permit to go through town, which I don't think is really the can of worms you want to open, you do have to let them through and you have to let them on all the roads. But you could, I can see Scott's point, that you could make them get a permit to come through the town of Pomfret because this town doesn't allow dirt bikes. Therefore, you must get a permit if you want to drive a specific dirt bike through here. But that's the only way you're going to exclude them. And even then, they have to be able to be allowed if they buy the permit.
There's been a lot of news lately about ETVs in some towns. So it might be a good idea for us
They don't classify as ATVs. The state does not recognize any type of dirt bike or motorcycle on or off-road as an ATV. They're a motorcycle.
I understand that. But the point I'm trying to make is that in terms of allowing dirt bikes or ATVs on town highways, it's generally the same rules. And so if you look at our ordinance, it doesn't say a single thing about whether it's registered or not. It simply bans all ATVs from town highways. So there's nothing in our town ordinance about that says, but if you have a registered ATV, you may drive it on town highway. It basically says ATVs are prohibited from town highways, period.
But motorcycles are banned from town highways. A dirt bike is just a motorcycle.
I understand that, but my point is that an ATV that's registered does not somehow make it legal to be on the town highway in Pomfret.
That is true with an ATV. However, a motorcycle is not an ATV. John has just cited that to you. And so it is a different kettle of fish, and it's a different category. And if it's registered, we cannot exclude it. We may permit it so that it can go through here, as Kathy might have suggested, but we cannot exclude it.
I would differ. I don't know that that's true, Emily. I think we would want to find out if that's in fact the case, because I think just from what I'm reading, from our ordinance and what I've read with other towns, it doesn't matter whether it's registered or not. The town has the authority to prohibit these kinds of things from town highways.
I think one thing that might be missed here too is you can call them a dirt bike, but there's actually a dirt bike like you would use for competition on these tracks where they got moguls and all that. And then there's also a dirt bike that has on-road, off-road type tires and so forth that has all the headlights, the turn signals, brake lights, all of that kind of stuff. And I think that's what Emily's talking about, that those bikes can be registered and are road legal. They can even go up and down the interstate, as where the actual dirt motocross, I guess is the word I'll use, dirt bike, are the bikes that they don't have no lights on them. And so there's two different bikes that we're talking about. And so motocross dirt bikes are the ones that we, in my opinion, would not want. And the state says is illegal to be on our roads, period.
Right. So I have a question. No experience with motorcycles. Is a dirt bike registered differently from a motorcycle?
No.
No. It's what they call them an on-road, off-road bike.
Yeah, I get that. But so I'm wondering, the town of Woodstock, you are required to have a permit to drive a motorcycle through the town?
I'm not aware of that, but.
Well, that's what Kathy said.
No, I was talking about they make the big trucks get a permit to go through the town of Woodstock and Bridgewater all the way to the
border. Okay. Oh, yeah, I know.
So
I
that thought type of permit. So they can stop certain specific vehicles and say, you must have a permit to drive on this section of roads. So if we wanted to stop them at the edge of town and check all their permits, which would then require enforcement of that, et cetera, you could do that. But these dirt bikes are, if they can get a plate for them, they are exactly the same as any other motorcycle. They have to have sound emission requirements, fuel emission. It's exactly the same as a car or any other motorcycle, and they can go anywhere a car or motorcycle can. There's nothing ATV about them.
Right.
And it's a matter of filling your motorcycle that you own, fitting all of those requirements of the state, and just going to the DMV and getting your plates and your registration and your inspection. It's no different. So they're not ATV like at all. You're just calling them dirt bikes because they're loud and obnoxious.
Right. But I got that.
They don't require motorcycles. So, I was talking about like the trucks that have to go through Woodstock. That's the only way you can classify certain vehicles to go on certain roads.
So you're suggesting that we could classify, I don't know how you would do that. So
I don't think you want to. I was just meaning that would be the only way you could get around it, because they are street legal and you have to let them in pretty much.
Woodstock, Bridgewater, and Hartford only get away with that with those 53 footers with a special agreement that they have with the state. Yeah. The state permits them to be able to do that. So you'd have an agreement with the.
So you just wouldn't be able to do that. No.
I'm looking at the statute right now, and by definition, ATVs are non-highway vehicles.
Correct. But it's the state a while ago made it so that individual towns could permit them on their secondary roads, because there are several up, and especially in the Northeast Kingdom. I've been up there myself, and you can go through certain roads that they've permitted them on.
South Royalton has that as well. There's certain roads over there that they use.
You know, follow all the traffic laws and all of those things.
The bottom line is here, we don't know any answers to change anything or consider anything at this point. So I think we need to do some research if indeed we want to do anything with dirt bikes at all. The other thing that if you want to put some teeth into these back roads and speeding dirt bikes, cars, whatever kind of vehicle it is, we can go the way of some roads, like Woodstock has over in the Spalding district, and we can reduce the speed limits on these back roads. It is absolutely insane to have a 50 mile an hour speed limit on these back roads, and yet when I've brought that up before, no one will buy into that, and no one says we can do that. But we can do that. Woodstock does that. And quite frankly, that would take care of your speeding dirt bikes as well, because they wouldn't be within the speed limit.
Can do that. It's not necessarily a bad idea. You just have to have a traffic study done that will make it so that you can actually enforce that, because without the traffic study, if somebody takes it to court and they, you know, the person smart enough to take it to court and says, hey, well, you know, what's the traffic study to say the speed limit should be on this road? And they go, oh, there isn't one. Well, then it does default to 50, but they can also give them a ticket for driving too fast for road conditions or reckless, you know, endangerment and all these other things. Ben has his hand up. Brickner.
Hi. Okay. I apologize. I joined a little late in this part of the discussion. Has it come up whether ATVs are allowed on town highways, permitted or not?
They are not,
according to our ATV ordinance.
Okay. I was reminded to join this meeting as an ATV went tooling by about 20 minutes ago on Pomfret Road. I'm not sure whose it was, but there were several individuals in the back bed as well on the road. Is there
Did you say dead on the road or in the back bed on the road?
There were someone in the, you know, the driver's position, and I think there was someone riding on the bed in the back of the ATV as well.
Anyway, I don't think we're getting anywhere with this conversation until we get more information. Is it agreeable that we all move on?
Yes.
Anybody object?
Nope.
Okay.
Emily, sorry, is there a way to, when, so if ATVs are not allowed on town highways, how does one have that enforced when it actually occurs? Is it a matter of the state police just seeing it for themselves when they do their patrol?
Well, it's or not, you can if, report if it. You can
if
report
someone were this. Doing that on a regular basis, you could call the state police and they probably would, if for instance, let's just say Joe Schmo had lost his car driver's license because of an alcohol infraction, and he was driving his lawnmower to the bar at 5 o'clock every day to get a couple drinks because he'd lost his license. You could call the state police and say, Joe Schmo lost his license. He's driving drunk with his lawnmower to the bar to get more booze. Can you do something about this? And they will stop him.
Okay.
So you can instigate, you can, by calling the state police, if you know there's an infraction that occurs fairly regularly, you can instigate a complaint and they probably will follow up on that complaint.
We okay. also, as a select board, have the power to issue citations.
Got it. Thank you.
Anything else before we leave the ATV dirt
the
bike ordinance?
I have with the ATV stuff is, and I could get clarification myself, but you know, we all, at least three of our the select board members here, are also have farms where we run up and down the roads with our tractors, and they're being exempt. There's plenty of people in Pomfret that have ATVs that are also farmers. So it would be nice to know how that those are classified both under this ordinance as well as the state, if they're being used as a tractor for in between fields. Are they classified as an agricultural piece of equipment and are therefore exempt from that, or are they not?
But you're talking
about, I think
that
would be a good question to ask.
You're talking about operating them on private property, correct, John?
No, going from one field to another, which includes road traffic. You can drive your agricultural tractor or other piece of agricultural equipment between fields and farm property on town highways without needing plates even. If it's a private tractor and you want to drive it to your neighbor's house, to push back his snowbanks, legally it has to have a plate on it, and then you can drive that tractor on the road. But I don't know how the state views a farmer going between fields on his four-wheeler.
Yeah, nor do I.
Oh, you old Vermont farmers are going to be going so slow on your ATVs, nobody's going to care anyway.
I might buy one just to drive by your house really fast, Chuck.
Well, stop and pick me up and we'll go to the bar and have a couple of beers.
Sounds like a plan, if only one would be open. Are we ready for meeting wrap up now?
I think so.
Hallelujah. We
have to do the date change for the truck.
Oh, yes.
I need a motion to change the date on the truck RFP due date.
July 15th.
So moved.
Second.
All those in favor? Aye. John?
Aye.
Chuck?
Aye.
Scott?
Aye.
Steve?
Aye.
Myself? Aye. Select board correspondence. The Planning Commission is working on, and they sent, I think, to you guys, a survey regarding the White River watershed and flood situations and whether the floodplain maps needed to be changed. I gave that to them. That was correspondence that I got. And if you know of anything that is flood-related that caused a problem, for instance, in Irene, we should tell them about it, and they're going to fill out that document and send it back. Other than that, and the Forest Service appointment of Frank. The only other piece of correspondence is regarding, was regarding Artistry / Purple Crayon Tego Enterprises going underneath the road and the brook, and that was a natural resources document. So they will inform us what they're doing regarding their request to go under the brook.
Do we know if they were digging up the road, or are they directional drilling the whole thing? Do we know?
They're boring.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think that that is also going to be part of going under the road will have to be something that we will talk to Mr. Warden about. I assume they're going to bore, but I don't know.
Yeah, that's what he said earlier. Yeah.
Review of assignments. Scott, are you going to redo that conflict of interest policy?
Yep.
So that we can adopt it next time?
Yep.
And we're all going to look at the winter maintenance policy and the personnel policy. And I will check into the town hall COVID-19 situation to get more information there. And what other things do we have, Cindy?
You're going to ask the state police to send reports?
Yes. And I will do that when I send back the contract. Any other items, assignments that I have forgotten?
I don't think so. We have some postponed agenda items.
What are those?
The brick building and the truck RFP. And we're going to look into the town hall.
Okay. And just as an aside, and I should have asked you earlier, Steve, have you heard anything from John Morgan as to when he's going to start down at the town garage?
I haven't heard anything since spring. He said the middle of July, so I'll get in touch with him and see what his schedule's looking like.
That would be great, and then I can let the painter know. Agenda items for next meeting? I guess we've kind of covered that. So we need a motion to adjourn.
So moved.
Need a second?
Second.
All those in favor? Aye. John?
Aye.
Chuck?
Aye.
Steve?
Aye.
Scott?
Aye.
And myself, aye. And we do have, Cindy, will you notice that executive session for next Wednesday at 7 o'clock?
Yes.
And Jimmy will be on board at 7:30 and you at 8.
Yes.
Excellent. There's one other thing. Do we want to continue with these Zoom meetings, or do we want to have in-person meetings with the opportunity for the public to come in on a conference call? You might want to think about that and how we want to proceed in the future.
Good.
Maybe we can put that on the agenda for the next meeting as to what we want to do in that regard.
Sounds good.
So we've adjourned, yes?
Yes.
Yeah.
Excellent. Good night, all.
Night. Night.